CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor, welcoming Ben and Ben Talablu, Senior Fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Iran is the story. The Iran deal, JCPOA of 2015, is the debate. But there are many items that connect to this loosely. We cannot connect the dots, but we can cite the news that is confirmed as much as it can. This is the fog of tyranny, the fog of war. Therefore, Ben, a very good evening to you. The story of a potential abduction of an American citizen out of Manhattan, the FBI confirming some of the details now, the abduction pointed to Iran, cutouts, agents, an intrigue that is worthy of a screenplay from the 1930s with Humphrey Bogart. What sense do you make of this? Is this an independent outfit, you know, like rogue agents? Does this look like Iran provoking the Biden administration? How do you interpret this of what we know so far? Good evening to you, Ben.
A very good evening to you, John. Always a pleasure to be with you. It is indeed a very scary time because it is Iran's long reach. And it's essential to contextualize this long reach onto American soil. In 1980, Iran used a disaffected American convert to Islam to kill a former Shah-era diplomat in Maryland. In 2001, Iran hatched a convoluted scheme with ties to the Quds Force for a washed-up Iranian car salesman in Texas to enlist a Mexican drug cartel to help attempts to kill the Saudi ambassador in a Washington, D.C. Italian restaurant. And now in 2021, we have at least four individuals in Iran still at large tied to one woman in California who helped try to pay an American private investigation company to trace, track, photograph, and take video of an American citizen of Iranian origin who is a journalist and a human rights activist based in Brooklyn. We now know through reporting that it was Masih Alinejad, the famous human rights activist who does White on Wednesdays and My Stealthy Freedom, and the anti-hijab activist based in Brooklyn. Things involved in that plot were the attempt to take her to Venezuela, the attempt to put her on a speedboat, lots of crazy stuff going on here. Ultimately, Iran from 1980 to 2011 to 2021 was undeterred from reaching onto American soil. It brought itself onto American soil. This, I think, if it is not properly punished or pushed back on, is likely to continue. The gaps between 1980 and 2011 and 2021 do not represent Iran being deterred or afraid. They represent Iran recalculating and recalibrating. And I think now that they dare to go after a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil, I think this says that many of our impressions about the regime's risk tolerance are far off the mark.
Ben, I have not seen a report, but I will ask the question without knowing the answer. Always unwise, but what the heck? Does anybody assume, well-informed people about Iran's activities, that we have Iranian cells among us for a long time? That Iran is a bad actor, stalking American citizens, threatening American citizens? Something so fantastic, it sounds like a screenplay. Have we heard anything like this before?
Well, we know of their ability to reach onto soil. We know of their ability to tap into the diaspora. We know of their ability, I think most importantly, to try to use members of people's own family who are in the diaspora as blackmail against them, to try to do harm to their friends and their families, their loved ones. And this stuff is global, John. This most recent plot, which was thwarted and exposed, also had tentacles in places like Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United Arab Emirates. This was not limited to American soil. Iran may indeed have this as a global operation. We've seen them try to enlist members of Lebanese Hezbollah, for instance, in 2012 to engage in that bus bombing that killed six people in Bulgaria. We've seen the long reach of these guys in Germany in the 1990s. We've seen more recently across Europe a resumption of an Iranian assassination campaign against dissidents and other sorts of activists in, of course, the European continents. And lest we forget the multiple dual nationals and foreign citizens, many of which are European, that still linger as hostages inside Iran. I'm not saying that they have cells everywhere, but they so far have not been deterred from or feared the creation of a cell or bringing agents or affiliates or money or terror onto multiple continents to continue to adjudicate their foreign and security policy. This is scary stuff.
Within these last days, a report that the outgoing foreign secretary, Zarif, the man who, with John Kerry, negotiated the JCPOA deal in Vienna in 2014-2015, and during the Trump administration was often cited as visiting with John Kerry, carrying on conversations about restoring the JCPOA that had been nixed by the Trump administration, Mr. Zarif is telling the Majlis, the parliament in Tehran, that a framework of possible agreement has been reached. And what is so amazing about this framework is that it includes everything you need to know about Iran having a nuclear weapon, including that everything sunsets much faster than we thought within 4 years. First question, Benham, the enemy gets a vote. Can we trust this release, this leak of what Zarif wrote or told the Majlis? This could be more provocation. It could also be Zarif throwing a smoke bomb into the limousine as he got kicked out by the new regime.
You know, there's multiple options here. I've heard from different people, different reporters, different analysts, but there's also what my gut itself believes, which is that there could be a kernel of truth to this. Ultimately, if you look at the penalties that Zarif is telling the Iranian parliament that have been agreed upon, and again, it's an allegation, no one can confirm this. He says the penalties that have been agreed upon, you look at some of them, for instance, the four pieces of legislation that is mentioned there and the penalties, oil, financial, shipping, insurance, banking, delistings of banks. These things happened in 2015 and were written into Annex 2, which is the sanctions relief annex of the five-part deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So some of the stuff is clear copy and paste and would be predicted if the U.S. did do a 180 and try to return and resurrect that fatally flawed and fast-expiring deal. But there are new things mentioned, and there are things that have been kind of trickled out in the Iranian press. And we know that, for instance, when it comes to U.S. partners in Northeast Asia, like Korea and Japan, Iran has selectively leaked things and put out bits of misinformation about potential sanctions relief or potential access to foreign exchange or potential unfreezing or freezing of Iranian accounts in those countries for really about 6 to 9 months to try to weaponize the U.S. relationship with those countries to its own benefit, to make it look like Iran had everyone else over a barrel. So there are multiple competing explanations here. One is that there's a kernel of truth. Two is of course, that Iran is trying to do this to put pressure on the U.S. And three, of course, it could be something domestic. I actually think this is the least probable. I'm not saying that there is no factionalism. There certainly is a long history of factionalism inside the Islamic Republic, particularly from the beginning, especially when the nuclear issue kicked off. But I think that the Rouhani and Raisi administrations, meaning the outgoing and incoming administrations in Iran, will be able to play good cop, bad cop on this nuclear issue, particularly in the last few weeks. There are reports, for instance, that the seventh round of negotiations will kick off at some point in mid-August. That would be early in the Raisi presidency. We have no details on what potential team may be there or what the timeline may look like. But ultimately, kidnapping or no kidnapping, Zarif or no Zarif, America remains doggedly interested in this deal. And that is what permits Iran to have leverage.
The original deal, did it include what this report of Zarif telling the Majlis said, that Iran would keep the most advanced centrifuges in Iran? Was that in the original JCPOA?
One of the many shortcomings of the JCPOA was rather than Iran destroy a lot of these advanced machines that it had, Iran would simply disconnect and put them into storage. One reason the JCPOA is so bad is that it is not a physical impediment to a nuclear weapon. It is a political agreement that kicks the can down the road to the resumption of physical access to what could eventually become a nuclear weapon.
The facts on the ground, apart from Zarif's politicking, the facts on the ground are that Iran has made remarks certifying that it is increasing enrichment to 60%, quite in violation of anything you could interpret from 2015. The IAEA makes it very clear that that is a violation. Is there anything that you've heard, because there's nothing in the Zarif report, that says that Iran is going to stop that or knows this provocation is unacceptable? Is there anything in the what we know of Vienna about that 60% to reverse it?
One of the things about the Iranian escalatory strategy is that they say that everything is reversible, but there are certain things that are not reversible, such as knowledge, such as experience, such as interest, for example. Iran has been talking about going to 60%, which is technically HEU, highly enriched uranium. Anything over 20% is HEU, highly enriched uranium. Iran's been talking about that since 2010 or 2012. So almost a decade or a little over a decade, Iran has been talking about going to 60%. But the experience gained from actually rushing to 60%, practicing potentially for breakout even, staggering and organizing the centrifuges in a certain fashion, rushing to actually produce this material, storing the material, this is not even knowledge that you can bomb out of their heads. This is something you cannot fundamentally reverse or fundamentally unlearn. If the Iranians are sincere and if the Americans are sincere and everyone does go back to a JCPOA baseline, that means nothing above 5%. But as, you know, to borrow a phrase from the recently deceased former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, one of the issues with the deal is that there were many unknown unknowns.
What we have then is a moving story. So one more detail about where we are right now. The concern is that the U.S. president does not have a clear authority to respond to Iran as an aggressor state. I believe it's Senator Rubio who has mentioned the War Powers Act. But this is the Republican speaking in a highly partisan environment. So how do you interpret this dialogue between the senator from Florida and the White House?
And there's a third party or a third actor that I think our audience needs to be aware of, which is a series of Iran-backed militias inside Iraq, which if you look at from the beginning of the Biden administration in January 2021 to present, there are, by my count, if you count rockets and drones, a minimum of 26 independent strikes, and this is my number through open source information, 26 independent strikes featuring rockets and or drones against facilities, bases, buildings inside Iraq associated with the U.S. force presence. This could include the embassy. This could include the Green Zone. This could include multiple places where coalition forces and Americans are found inside that country. The U.S. response ratio under President Biden is 2. So it is 2 American strikes for 26. And while I fully believe in and defend the president's Article 2 ability to cite a self-defense issue and respond forcefully using force, I think the nature of the strikes, coupled with the highly partisan environments, coupled with the drama over Iraq and AUMFs to begin with, necessitates that if Washington is going to engage in a repealing of the AUMF about Iraq, and if it is sincere, this is an if it is sincere about pushing back on Iran in the heartland of the Middle East, it will need an AUMF against SMGs, against Shia militia groups that are backed by Iran. You could tailor it, narrow it to make sure it's not a prelude to a war with Iran. You could tailor it, narrow it so it's only applicable to sanctioned militias that have demonstrated ties to Iran. You could do all you want with it. But the problem is, in 2021 alone, there have been 26 strikes by a group of people that we don't have the clearest of authorizations to fire against. And we can only return fire or defend or do things of that nature. I think this would be a move to restore the balance between Congress and the executive. It's getting an AUMF on the Hill is an act of God, so I'm not even going to talk about it any further. But in this environment, when the U.S. is retreating from the region, when there seems to be a bipartisan consensus about repealing all past authorizations for the use of military force, we need to understand what that means on the ground. And it means that it is to the benefit of our adversaries. And that just as happened in 2011, when the U.S. was withdrawing from Iraq, there was an uptick in the cycle of violence to cement the impression that Iran was kicking our butt out the door. The same thing is likely to happen again.
Ben and Bentaleblu, senior fellow from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, discussing Iran. And when we come back, the concern about Iran extends to the fact that the newly elected president-elect, Mr. Raisi, is declaring there will be no negotiations until he's in authority. What does it mean that a man who is associated with known mass murderers is to be the new president of Iran? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.